Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. On Thursday, September 17th, the United States will default on its debts unless Congress approves a spending bill and increases the debt ceiling. But for the first time in the history of the nation, ideology is being put above the security of the national and global economies. House Republicans have demanded that the Affordable Health Care Act be defunded and have refused to consider any spending bill without this provision. Republicans contend that Democrats must compromise, but Democrats liken the tactics to extortion. Now, a coalition of the most prominent leaders in business, labor, and the nonprofit world are urging that the shutdown end immediately to avoid the default. In a joint letter sent to President Obama and Congress, leaders from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the AFL-CIO, and United Way Worldwide said the shutdown must end now. The letter said, "While we may disagree on priorities for federal policies and we even have conflicting views about many issues, we are in complete agreement that the current shutdown is harmful and the risk of default is potentially catastrophic for our fragile economy." The letter added, "No one benefits from the current shutdown, and everyone will be harmed if the government defaults." Business leaders fear a failure to raise the debt ceiling by the October 17th deadline will send the stock market into a tailspin and plunge the economy into recession. That would have worldwide ramifications, international economics experts warn. A growing coalition in Congress is now asking the Speaker to allow a clean spending bill without the health care defunding to be brought up for a vote. But in the latest stealth move, House Republicans changed the rules. Before, any member of Congress could claim a point of privilege to force a vote if a majority of House members agreed. A petition to that effect has been circulating through Congress. But now with the rule change, nothing can be brought up for a vote without the approval of House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, leaving even Speaker John Boehner powerless to end the crisis, it seems. Already, the shutdown has harmed millions of Americans, including workers furloughed without pay and recipients of federal aid programs such as the Women, Infants, and Children Supplemental Nutrition Support Program for poor women and their children, which has been completely cut. National parks and forests remain closed, while loans for small businesses and students are on hold. If the government defaults, the pain would be deepened. It is unclear how or if the government could continue to fund Social Security and Medicare, the military, air traffic controllers, the FBI, and other key functions of the federal government. Among local leaders, a partisan divide remains, since thus far, Republicans Duncan Hunter and Daryl Issa both voted for the spending bill that defunded health care reforms known as Obamacare, while Democrats voted against it. Neither of the Republicans locally has called for a raise in the debt ceiling to prevent the U.S. from defaulting on its debts. America has never before defaulted on its debt, nor has any political party ever threatened to allow this to happen before this current Congress. Tea Party Republicans have contended that these drastic tactics are the only way to force huge federal spending cuts to rein in what they view as out-of-control debt. Tea Party Republicans have pushed their party to the brink of collapsing the world economy, according to some, in an effort to push through ideological views. But far from saving money, the costs over the long run to the U.S. economy are apt to prove extremely costly if the economy plunges into recession, business leaders now warn. Opponents of these tactics note that the president was reelected on a promise to enact health care reforms and that the will of the majority of voters should be respected, they say. If voters disagree, they will have the ultimate say when they go to the ballots in November of next year. Increasingly, polls show vast dissatisfaction among voters with Congress overall. Approval ratings are now at historic lows for both Congress and the Republican Party.
This is Leon Thompson.
And this is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine's Local Government Report on KNSJ.
Lemon Grove City Council will meet on Tuesday. The council will interview Planning Commission candidates and consider a resolution to appoint one of the candidates to serve a two-year term. A budget report for the first quarter of fiscal year 2013 and 2014 will be presented. Council will also continue a hearing from September on vending carts and kiosks. In addition, Lemon Grove's council members will hear a report on the impacts of relocating a sheriff's substation from Lemon Grove to Rancho San Diego.
Santee's City Council has voted to allow annexation of the controversial Castle Rock development project, meaning that the land will be transferred from the city of San Diego to Santee. Pardee Homes plans to build 283 single-family homes, 147 multiple-family dwellings, and a public park on the project. The council has fought to oppose Castle Rock on the boundary of Santee and San Diego, but the city of San Diego approved it. Unable to block the projects, Santee's council has now decided to allow annexation so that developer fees and property taxes from the new homes will be paid to Santee, and in turn, Santee will provide services such as fire protection. An open space near Mission Trails Regional Park will remain within the city of San Diego. Opponents have criticized the project for environmental impacts, traffic, and flood control issues. Many at the council meeting voiced frustration objecting to San Diego forcing the project onto Santee against the wishes of many residents and officials. Mayor Randy Vopel asked openly if anyone could think of anything the city could do to stop the project short of a costly lawsuit with uncertain results. But in the end, council voted 3-2 for annexation. Padre Dam Water District must also approve the annexation this week. The mayor has often been on opposite sides with environmentalists in the past, notably with Preserve Wild Santee, a group led by Van Collinsworth. But ironically, at the Castle Rock hearing, Mayor Vopel noted the environmental group's successful track record of lawsuits halting projects in the past. In his final words on Castle Rock to a standing-room-only crowd, the mayor advised, "I recommend Pardee not underestimate Collinsworth and his group." He concluded, "This isn't over yet."
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities.
Plans for a proposed casino at the Hamul Indian Village on Highway 94 have cleared a key hurdle. A senior advisor to Governor Jerry Brown, Jacob Applesmith, in a letter to Hamul's tribal chairman, confirmed that the tribe has met tribal state gaming compact requirements for its proposed casino. The governor's advisor added that the state supports the tribe's efforts to mitigate all significant off-reservation impacts, including widening portions of Highway 94. Hamul Tribal Chairman Raymond Hunter praised the governor's collaborative spirit toward making the tribe's vision become a reality. The project plans include a casino with restaurants, underground parking, and a fire station on site. The tribe has reduced the size and height of its original proposal and made other changes in response to community concerns. But neighbors who oppose the project are voicing criticism after learning that the governor's staffer met with tribal representatives approximately 20 times over the past 3 years. The governor's aide said he personally inspected the project site and toured State Route 94, as well as meeting with Caltrans and Supervisor Diane Jacob. Hamulians Against Casinos, a community group opposed to the project, wants to know why the governor's office has never met with community members to discuss impacts or concerns. The group objects to what they call closed-door meetings between the governor's office and key decision-makers. Opponents of the project point out that many fatality accidents have occurred on Highway 94, and they contend that increased traffic from the casino cannot be mitigated. In September, Hamul Action Committee and the Hamul Community Church filed a lawsuit against the National Indian Gaming Commission and the Bureau of Indian Affairs in federal court seeking to halt the project. Eric Lund, general manager of the San Diego East County Chamber of Commerce, said the chamber will review the proposed project with its members and communities. He noted that the casino would provide thousands of much-needed jobs in our region. Tom Lemon, business manager with the San Diego County Building and Construction Trades Council, called the employment opportunity, quote, a welcome sight for working families across the region, unquote, adding that the casino would create both apprenticeship opportunities and jobs. Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, and I'm here today with Larry Poole. Larry is a professional horseman who lives right here in San Diego's East County. He's also an actor, a stuntman, a movie wrangler, and a trail boss with the Hole in the Wall gang. Welcome to the show, Larry.
Thanks for having me, Miriam.
Now, you have been involved in so many different things, it's hard to know where even to start, but I understand that some of the movies you've been involved in were filmed right here in East County, so let's start there. Tell us about a Sierra Nevada gunfight.
We filmed that out in Descanso on Boulder Creek at the Devil's Punch Bowl.
Very famous landmark out here over by the Three Sisters Falls.
Beautiful location, and we were able to film with some A-list Hollywood stars, Michael Madsen, mm-hmm. John Savage, Kirk Harris.
Without giving anything away, what's the movie about?
It's set in the 1870s gold rush of Southern California, right after the Civil War.
Mm.
It's about a Civil War veteran who, with his son, comes to Southern California to hunt for gold.
And what did you do in the movie?
I supplied the horses and did some of the stunt riding.
Oh, my goodness. Stunt riding, I guess, is a pretty exciting field. How on earth did you get involved in that?
Been riding horses since I was a young child and was able to pull off some great scenes with crossing the rivers and made some good horses to put the actors on. Just had a great time.
Very good. Do you ever get hurt doing that?
Couple of times.
Couple times. So what are some of the other stunts you've done in the movies?
You know, anything from getting attacked by zombies to crossing Death Valley in a covered wagon to swimming horses across rivers.
Wow, and I saw a photo there of you standing on horseback even, so you've got a lot of acrobatic skills must take to do that. Who are some of the celebrities, the movie stars that you've been in pictures with?
Danny Trejo, the star of the movie Heat. John Savage from the movie The Godfather and Deer Hunter. Michael Madsen from all the Quentin Tarantino movies. Mark Boone from A Sons of Anarchy.
I think there's a Star Trek actor as well.
Tuvok from Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
So you must have quite the family photo album there. Is the genre of Western movies making a comeback?
I hear it's the biggest selling genre of all the American films overseas. They love American cowboys overseas, and we hope to see Westerns make a comeback.
Interesting. Well, that would certainly bode well for the Western settings that we have across East County, including the ranch where I met you out there in Descanso, the Buckle Ranch. They had some really interesting buildings that I guess were just recently constructed. Everything from a blacksmith shop to a barn looked like a movie setting. What are some of the other settings that you've filmed on location at besides the San Diego area?
Well, we've filmed at Paramount Ranch Movie Studios. We've filmed at Melody Ranch, Gene Autry Studio. And we filmed on location in Death Valley, San Bernardino, Ventura County, where they filmed Little House on the Prairie. We filmed in Borrego.
So what's next? Do you have anything else coming up?
Possibly have one coming up in November up in L.A. We'll be filming a Western.
Now, another movie coming out, I understand, is called Mountain Duel that was also filmed out here. Can you tell us a little bit about that movie?
How was that? Was actually filmed in Descanso also. Great movie. It's in the post-production phase right now.
And what era is that set in? Can you tell us a little about the plot?
That's a Bigfoot movie.
Bigfoot. So we've got Bigfoot right out here in East County, at least on the silver screen.
And you'll see some great San Diego footage in that movie also. It just, this area translates so well onto film. It's just a beautiful area to work.
Fascinating. I understand they're looking for distributors, so watch for that one soon, too. What are some of the other things that you've been in, TV, movie?
We, earlier this year, filmed Quick Draw up at Paramount Ranch. That's showing on Hulu right now. It's original programming for Hulu. That's the new media.
Very interesting. And Rise of the Lone Star Ranger, I think, is another recent film you had some involvement with?
That was filmed at Paramount Ranch up in Hollywood, starring Danny Trejo and Jason Patrick.
Now, you also participated in a pretty big ride recently, I understand. Tell me about that.
Had the honor of riding with Gene Glasscock, the long rider.
And how long was the ride?
The ride went for 3 years from San Diego to Jekyll Island, Georgia, and back to San Diego.
My goodness. And it was a mule-drawn covered wagon, I understand. What portion of that did you go along on?
We crossed California twice, from San Diego to Yuma and back.
Kind of like in Death Valley Days.
Kind of like in Death Valley Days.
There you go. Now, you have a trail ride coming up, I understand, with the Hole in the Wall Gang, which is a Western reenactment and riding group out here.
We have an annual ride that culminates yearly in Borrego Springs for the Borrego Desert Days Festival. That will be finishing on October the 26th.
And when does it start and where?
Starts the weekend before. It's a week-long ride, heading north on the Pacific Crest Trail to the Warner Springs area, and then veering east is the way we normally do it, and we ride into Borrego Springs and kick off their Desert Days Festival.
Very interesting. So the public is certainly invited to that, and they can come see you at that particular event.
They can see us at the Borrego Days Parade on October the 26th.
Now, your group has been around since about 1940, I understand, the Hole in the Wall Gang. How did it all start?
We were started by returning World War II veterans that had a love of horses and horsemanship. They started a nonprofit benefiting local charities that have horse interests. We currently turn a lot of money to the Magic Horse. That's one of our favorite charities off of El Monte Road.
I'm familiar with them. They do amazing work out there helping disabled children with a therapy program on horseback, and it helps them improve their coordination, and some very good people out there.
I've seen it for myself, the wonderful things they do, and it's just amazing to see how a horse can reach into the closed-off mind of an autistic child and open them up. And I've been told that nothing else worked, and yet that small child that had severe disabilities just seems like a normal child to me. We've dealt with horsemanship for the handicapped in the past and a number of other organizations, but usually it's for the children, although lately we've been getting more involved with the Wounded Warrior Foundation.
Yeah, and full disclosure here, the Hole in the Wall Gang was one of the Western reenactment groups that also donated their time at our recent benefit for our nonprofit, East County Magazine, and our wildfire alerts out in Descanso, and I know that everyone enjoyed the show there. You've got another event, I think, coming up in the spring with a different group you're involved in. Can you give us some information about that?
In April, we're going to be appearing at the Night of the Horse in Del Mar.
Mm-hmm. And what is the Night of the Horse?
Night of the Horse is a yearly event centered around the Del Mar National Horse Show.
A lot of East County people involved in that, I imagine. Lots of horses out here.
I understand they're signing up the Victorian Roses Ladies Riding Society, and we've got some Hollywood acts coming down. Professional horsemen from around the country are going to be involved.
You've worked in a lot of movies, a lot of Hollywood celebrities, and a lot of different things, I'm sure, that go on the set. What's it like working there on the set, and do you have any particular memories that stand out in your mind about your movie career?
Well, you know, it's harder work than I ever gave it credit for. Long days, typically 16 to 18 hours, very tiring. And a lot of fun.
Well, it must be great to be living out the dream, so to speak, really doing something that a lot of people probably only dream about and that you and the others involved in this get to do.
I feel very fortunate to be involved. Met a lot of great friends. The folks I've worked with in Hollywood have all been fine, upstanding people. I've enjoyed meeting all of them and working with all of them.
Now, where can people get more information, Larry, if they want to find out about the Hole in the Wall Gang or about some of these movies? Is there a website you can suggest?
Of course, you can always Google Night of the Horse Del Mar and Hole in the Wall Gang Lakeside.
There you go. And the movie that's coming out that's on the shelves now is Sierra Nevada Gunfight, if you want to see some local scenery filmed right here in Descanso. Very good. Is there anything else, Larry, that I didn't ask about that you can think of that would be interesting that we should talk about?
Well, I think we've covered everything that I felt like I had to get off my chest this morning, Miriam. Thank you very much, Miriam. It's been a pleasure.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for joining us on 89.1 FM Descanso.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Nancy Holder, New York Times bestselling horror and fantasy author. My guest has received 5 Bram Stoker Awards for her supernatural fiction, a Scribe Award for her novel Saving Grace, Tough Love, which is based on the TV show with the same name, and a Pioneer Award from Romantic Times for young adult fiction. She's written 3 young adult dark fantasy series with Debbie Vigay and is currently writing teen thrillers and horror novels. Welcome, Nancy. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Hi, Raina. I'm glad to be here.
Nancy, you have a very impressive history of writing, editing, teaching, and other things. But let's start with your choice of genre. What are the joys and challenges of writing dark fantasy and horror novels? Why do you choose this category?
I have been asked this question all my life, and my answer to is, I do not know.
But
I do know it's a guilty pleasure. It's always been a guilty pleasure. Mm-hmm. When I'm writing horror or dark fantasy, I watch a horror movie almost every single day. I make a playlist, like a menu, what I'm going to watch every day. But I have to watch them in the morning because it takes me all day to get over it. I'm a big chicken. I will not be going to haunted trails. I will not be going into any haunted houses this Halloween. I'm too scared of them. There are lots of movies I can't watch. So I don't know what the attraction is because I can only take it so far for me. But when I'm writing, I go as far as I can to scare the pants off you.
Interesting. Now, do you watch these movies as inspiration while you're writing, or you every day of your life you watch a horror movie?
I watch them as inspiration while I'm writing, and I pick the movies that I pick. I watch a certain set of movies over and over and over to get an emotional effect out of myself, and then when I reach that, it's kind of like method writing. When I'm in that mode, then mm-hmm. I start writing. So if I want to be scared mm-hmm. or tense or uncertain or really terrified, I pick a certain movie to get myself emotionally there, and then I write.
And do you scare yourself with your writing?
No.
No.
And that used to really worry me. Like, I'm not scared at all. So I don't know why. I guess because I'm in control of it.
Right.
Maybe the movie I'm not in such control of. So.
Okay. Well, you also write material for properties like MTV's Teen Wolf, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Angel, Smallville, Hulk, Hellboy, Firefly, Zombies vs. Robots, and Saving Grace. How did you segue from horror novels to TV and movies, and which appeals to you the most?
Well, I have a really heartwarming story about that because I started out actually writing romance novels, and I had written 13 romances. And I started to kind of wonder, am I just redoing what I already did? And I was looking for something new. I had a mentor whose father had passed away. My mentor's name was Charlie Grant. And he said, you should go into your bookcase at home and see what you're reading. That's what you should be writing. And all of it was horror. So I started thinking about, maybe I should make a switch here. And because I started writing horror, I had written romance. I was working at Mysterious Galaxy Bookstore, and the owner, Mary Elizabeth Hart, heard me muttering to myself while I was dusting the novels based on the TV show Highlander. I said, these are really cool. I wonder if they need more authors. She actually emailed the editor while I was dusting. I got a phone call while I was at work.
Wow.
And I came up with 13 different ideas for Highlander. I got my my book contract for it while I was at work. I got docked an hour because I had to negotiate on the phone.
Oh, I'm sure you didn't mind that.
And then because of Highlander and because of my horror, that's how I moved into Buffy. And I wrote and still write Buffy. It's been going on 16 years now. So I've written more material about Buffy that's not show scripts than anybody else. And I absolutely adore Buffy, love Buffy. I will say my new passion is Teen Wolf. Teen Wolf is an excellent show. And I got to have a meeting with the creator of the show, Jeff Davis, who gave me some ideas of how to approach the novel I wrote for him. And I adore him. And oddly, his second in command, Russell Mulcahy, was the director of the original Highlander movie. So it's all come around full circle.
That's an amazing story.
Yeah, it's really cool.
So your process for writing shows for TV, is it the same as novels? Do you listen to those? Do you watch scary movies in the morning to inspire you?
What I tend to do when I'm writing tie-in for properties is watch that specific property as many times as possible. Read the scripts if I have them. Mm-hmm. And I do have a secret weapon, and my secret weapon is after I've watched the show so many times I've pretty much memorized it, I watch it without the sound. Because believe it or not, still, TV is a visual medium. And you see lots of things that the cinematographer, the director, the production designer have put in that if you're just watching it and listening, sometimes you miss all these visual cues.
So you transition out of the novel writing mode where you can be internal and get just visual.
Exactly.
That's fascinating. I know you also write comic books, graphic novel. Well, you're a graphic novel editor. How does that fit into the picture, and how is that creative process different?
Well, actually, it's a lot like watching my shows without the sound. Comics and graphic novels, for all that the writers want to say, especially in comics, is a visual medium. And I admire skilled comic book writers and graphic novel writers because, to me, it's second to poetry in how concise you have to be and how much you have to say in a very few number of words.
Right.
The text in comic books and graphic novels has severely decreased over the years.
Really?
There's a lot less writing, a lot more dependency on the art. Mm-hmm. And so you have to – one of the tricky things about comic books is it's sequential art, and you have to plan out the scenes so that when the person turns the page of the comic book, that's when they get the surprise. If your big reveal is in the middle of the page, then it's not like a cliffhanger at the end of a chapter of a novel. You have to plan for it. Mm-hmm. My writers and I both have to say a lot in a very, very few words and then give the artist a lot of help or guidance in how to portray what we're trying to show with words, because it is visual and the artist is king.
So it's a lot of collaboration and a whole new set of skills, really.
Yes. People say that comic book and graphic novel scripts are like movie scripts, but I disagree. I think they are letters to your artist. Hmm. You're telling your artist, this is what I want you to see that I'm seeing. And can you show other people what we too are seeing?
Let's change the subject a little bit. I want to talk about the writing community here in San Diego, which you are a very strong part of. I know you like to give back to the community. You've taught at the University of California here in San Diego. You participate in many conferences, book fairs, festivals, and other literary events. So what is that like for you, living and working here? Obviously, you could work in L.A. You do work in L.A. But being in San Diego and being involved with the local writing community, what's that like for you?
It's a joy. It is so wonderful to see how much vibrant writing there is in our hometown. There's conventions, Conjecture, Condor, Comic Book Fest, Comic-Con. We are the home of San Diego Comic-Con.
Yes.
And to just see everybody giving and taking and sharing and creating in our community is probably the most exciting part to me about being a writer. I went to Grossmont Community College, then I went to UC San Diego, and then to go back and teach at my alma mater was like a total rush. It was really, really cool. And a lot of writers, it's hard to be a freelance writer. And over time, sometimes people put up a lot of walls because we get a lot of requests for help or could you look at this? But when you connect with somebody and the only difference is that you've been doing it longer and you've had some success, there is no reason on earth that any writer in San Diego who walks into a bookstore and looks at those published books, there's no reason their book can't be on that shelf if they get enough support and some guidance. And that's what I like giving back to. That is a real rush to me.
So despite how busy you are and how successful, really, you enjoy mentoring other writers.
Absolutely. Yeah. I teach in a Master's of Fine Arts program for the University of Southern Maine. And
okay.
It's full residency. And to see one of my students get published is like, that's
great.
The best.
Right.
And there used to be the San Diego Writers Haven here.
I remember that.
I worked there. And I still get, people still are in contact with me, and several of my people, I had a workshop there, like an open mic night, and several of the people who used to come to that have been very, very successful, and that is just the best. That's fabulous to me.
Well, how wonderful that you're taking the effort with other
writers
like that.
Thank you.
Writers Helping Writers. One last question, Nancy. What book are you writing next, and when will it be available?
I am, as we speak, I'm on deadline to finish a teen thriller called The Rules, and I'm writing it with Debbie Vigay again.
Okay.
It will be out in 2015, I believe. We have a long lead time on this, which is fine with me, because I really want to get it right. So for my playlist for that one, I'm watching the Scream Quadrology. So I watch Scream, Scream 2, Scream 3, Scream 4, and I watch 30 minutes a day of each one, because that's when something happens. Every 15 minutes, Kevin Williamson is right on the money with how he laid out those scripts, and they're perfect for working on a teen thriller. And The Rules is the name of our book. It'll be out from Random House, Delacorte.
We look forward to reading it.
Thank you.
Well, our time is up, but thank you again for joining us.
Thank you so much, Raina. And to everybody out there who's an aspiring author, just keep going.
Okay. For more information on Nancy Holder, visit her website at www.nancyholder.com. She's also on Twitter at Nancy Holder and on Facebook at www.facebook.com/nancyholderfans. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
You are listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio 89.1 FM, Descanso.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers.
This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine and KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. As we approach the 10-year anniversary of the Cedar Fire, the worst wildfire in California history, it's important to speak with those who remember that event so that we will never forget. Today, my guest is Kathy Castle, a Cedar Fire survivor and community leader who has helped many others to rebuild their lives. Kathy, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Kathy and her husband Dave co-founded the Cedar Fire Rebuild Resource Group, which came about to help the survivors of the Cedar Fire. She is also involved with the Cedar Fire Historic Monument and the Lakeside Chamber of Commerce. Kathy, why don't we start, though, by having you tell us your own family's story. Where were you when you first got word about the Cedar Fire?
We were actually camping in Ocotillo Wells.
You were camping?
Yes.
And then what happened?
I received a phone call early in the morning letting me know that our house was on fire.
Your teenage daughter was there alone,
correct? My teenage daughter was home, and my son was at his apartment in El Cajon. Originally, I was fearful that it was something happening to the kids.
Because you got a call not from your daughter, but from someone else?
Correct. I received a phone call and saying that something bad had happened. But luckily, my sister-in-law, who happened to also be at the same place, let me know. No, my kids were fine. But that my house was on fire. So originally, we just believed it was just our house. We had no idea that the Cedar Fire was happening.
And your daughter had the presence of mind to get some things out safely and make some calls, I understand, to other family members to come help?
Yes, my daughter got out of the house and called her brother and my sister-in-law, and then they ran over. We were luckier than some families who had nothing but the pajamas or the clothes they were wearing. So I did have some family heirlooms and a few family photo albums.
Well, thank goodness for that. Now, when you decided to come back to town, what happened? At that point, did you realize that it was a wildfire or the scope of this disaster?
We still didn't. We were driving home. We were told not to come down 67, so we just thought it was the vacant lot near our home and maybe just our little neighborhood that might be having a fire. So so we had to go the back way over to 8, and we didn't really have cell phone reception. The radios really weren't announcing any disasters. If anything, it was always about Scripps Ranch area.
So when you finally reached Interstate 8 and looked to the west, what did you see?
Our jaw dropped. The mushroom clouds of smoke was overwhelming. And then we knew, no, this was much bigger than just our neighborhood.
My goodness. So you were reunited with your family at some point.
Yes, we met up with my kids, and we're happy to see that they were okay. And then we drove to the house, and pretty much there was just a fireplace standing. Everything else was collapsed in and burnt.
That must have been just emotionally devastating. How did you feel when you saw that?
I think you just kind of go numb. I don't even remember having any distinct feelings. It was just shock and numb and grateful that my kids were okay. It's just a lot of mixed emotions.
Now, it took you 2.5 years or so before you were able to finally rebuild. Tell us what happened in between. How did you get by? Where were you living?
In the beginning, we were living with our father-in-law, but because of our animals, we wanted to be able to oversee the rebuilding process. We purchased a fifth wheel and moved it onto our property and hooked it up to the electrical and water. And we basically camped for 2.5 years. And
so that camping trip got extended.
Camping trip extended. And so the process, it just took a while. We thought, oh, we'd be able to just jump right in, but there was just so many things, so many details to take care of.
Now, you mentioned that David had been through a tragedy in his past. His parents had lost their home to a fire a decade earlier. So were there lessons that he learned from what they went through that you two decided to try to spare others from going through? What was the genesis of starting the Cedar Fire Rebuild Resource Group?
Well, absolutely. We learned that dealing with insurance was an arduous process, and we knew it was going to take some time. We also knew that you kind of just have to always look forward and keep moving forward, not do a bunch of should have done this and should have done that. And we, you know, realized that at that time there was a building crunch going on. There was, you know, it was at the peak of building in San Diego. Resources were thin. General contractors were hard to find.
Yeah, to put this into perspective, this fire, the Cedar Fire, destroyed over 280,000 acres. It burned 2,820 buildings. I believe most of those were homes. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And, of course, 15 people lost their lives as well. So some families also were dealing with that tragedy. What were some of the concrete, tangible things that your group was able to do to help the fire survivors?
I think in the beginning, my husband's goal was that we would pool our resources, maybe make purchases together to get a bigger discount, knowing that insurance necessarily wouldn't cover everyone's cost in rebuilding. But we soon found out that that just wasn't going to work. Everybody was in a different place. There were some people that were already on the rebuilding road, and there were some people who were still digging through their ashes. So we found just sharing our stories, just knowing that we weren't alone, that we could work and support each other. We also shared resources in knowledge. Mm-hmm. One person would find a really good deal on, say, windows. Another person would say, hey, I just heard Home Depot's giving a discount. So our group turned into a resource rebuilding support group. We met once a week for probably almost 3 years.
Wow.
We communicated through Yahoo groups, sharing deals that we found. We would reach out to different companies like cabinet makers or window companies that would open their doors and host a little, you know, afternoon mixer and teach us, how do you pick good windows? How do you pick good cabinets? That kind of a thing.
Now, you've mentioned that the majority of the fire victims did not feel that the insurance companies were as fair with them as one might have hoped. What things can people who might be worried about suffering losses in a future fire do to maximize the chances that they will get the most possible recovery or coverage from their insurance company?
I would say, first of all, knowledge. Research. Learn exactly what the words mean on your insurance policy. Know exactly what your percentages are. Mm-hmm. Understand what it is. Don't take the word of your insurance agent.
Yeah, so things like full replacement and making sure that you've updated those policy limits periodically through the years.
Make sure that the valuations that they're using are appropriate. That the value to rebuild your house, the cost of living, those things that are all tied together.
Correct. What about proving what you lost? Is that something that was an issue for many of the people?
Yes. One of the tasks the insurance company assigns you is to list everything you have, but it's almost impossible.
I remember interviewing survivors of the Cedar Fire and other wildfires, and one that stands out in my mind was a man who fortunately had enough notice before he had to evacuate. He knew that order might be coming, and so he went around with a video camera and videotaped every wall and every room. He pulled open every drawer, every closet, and thoroughly documented. And so he was able to collect the maximum that the insurance policy would allow without any hassle, because he had documented that he actually had a lot more than the maximum value, whereas his neighbors were far less fortunate.
Yes, I would strongly suggest everyone either videotape or document what you have, and then either put it on the cloud or give it to a relative offsite.
Yeah, cloud storage is also a good idea for people who have home businesses or even family photos. Any of those records where they're just irreplaceable should a fire happen can be stored offsite, and that's, I think, pretty affordable these days.
I agree.
Are there people who to this day have not been able to rebuild who want to rebuild?
I don't have the up-to-date data on that. I know that there are some people who are still in the process of rebuilding, so they do want to rebuild.
So 10 years, it's taken an entire decade.
It's amazing, huh?
Why is that?
I think it'd be for a variety of reasons. Some of it is dealing with insurance, and then some of it is their choice in how they rebuild. Maybe their resources are limited, and so they have to actually do the physical labor themselves. Mm-hmm. And so they still have jobs and incomes to bring in. And so they're just basically building on the weekends.
One of the things that I've found truly inspiring is the positive spirit that so many fire survivors seem to have. They seem to find an inner strength, especially when it happens to entire communities like that. Has that been the case in Lakeside and with the other Cedar Fire survivors that you've dealt with?
It's been my experience, and I think for the most part, most of the other fire families that we've met, you know, it's kind of the American way. You are resourceful and you build bigger and better and you look for the silver lining. Mm-hmm. I've met some amazing people. I've had amazing people come into my life. I had, you know, strangers handing me money or resources or there's not even words to describe how grateful that gratitude of wanting to give back.
Yeah, there's a lot of good people out there in the San Diego community and East County communities, aren't there? Now, you also, I understand, got your job indirectly as a result of the Cedar Fire.
I did. The story basically is both my husband and I were so overwhelmed with the support that we received, we wanted to give back. And we knew in our lifetime there was no way we could monetarily pay people back. Mm-hmm. So that we chose that we wanted to give back in other ways by helping others. And I reached out to Robin Clegg, who was starting the East County Fire Relief Center. And I said, since I was unemployed, that I wanted to help her start that office.
Very good.
And so through her, so that's what I did between rebuilding and volunteering for the East County Fire Relief Center.
Yeah, now what was that all about?
The Fire Relief Center was established specifically to reach out to all the fire families and get them the resources that they needed. I believe it was funded mostly with Salvation Army funds. And so it was a place where fire families could go and say, hey, we don't have any clothing. Okay, here, this is what you can do. This is where you can go. Yeah.
Did the fire survivors also advocate for changes to make things safer for the future? For example, you mentioned the lack of communications and the fact that all they were talking about on TV when they covered it at all was Scripps Ranch when the fire burned into the city of San Diego, leaving East County people totally in the dark about what was going on.
I'm sure that a lot of the fire families did talk about it, but at that time, immediately after the fire, they were too busy trying to rebuild their lives. Mm-hmm. I would give more credit to those that didn't lose their homes, people who stepped up, politicians.
Good point.
Who stepped up, the fire departments. Mm-hmm. I think that they all saw what happened and said, we can do better. And
yes.
I think it was that group that actually initiated the change.
So now we have reverse 911,
correct,
and better communications. A lot of things have gotten better since then. You're also involved in the Cedar Fire Historic Monument, and I understand there's going to be a ceremony on October 26th related to that. What can you tell us about this project?
Yes, October 26th at the Lakeside Fire Department, we will be dedicating a piece of property that they are donating to the community to develop a historic monument.
And what will that look like? What will it include?
We're still in the design process. We're hoping to focus on the rebuilding and the regrowth that has happened, the lessons learned from the Cedar Fire, but also remember those families who lost family members.
Yeah, so those names will be enshrined on this memorial then.
Yes.
Very good. Well, you've certainly done an awful lot. I'm sure the people across East County, you know, owe a big thank you to you and your husband and the many others who came out and got involved working through your own losses to help others. And I understand that David's own family actually was one of those that benefited. Tell us what happened.
I don't know that I can even describe. I just want to go back a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
That the time and energy that David and I put into Cedar Fire has been paid back in more ways than I could even begin to count.
And then when the 2007 wildfires came along, that actually impacted your own family once again.
Yes. Unfortunately, my brother-in-law and sister-in-law lost their home in the 2007 fires.
Unbelievable.
But one of the things after our experiences, David's brother came to him and said, okay, what insurance company should I go with and what do I need to look for? And so because of our experiences, David was able to guide him and they had much better coverage than we did.
What can people do if they're looking for an insurance company? What questions should they ask or resources should they check to make sure they get the best possible, the most reputable type of company?
Like I said, I would just do research, go online, ask other people what their experiences have been. Mm-hmm. You could probably talk to people who have lost their home and they'll tell you which ones to go with and which ones not to go with. There are other resource groups out there that are specifically for insurance, and I would just do research.
Yeah, and I believe the California Department of Insurance has some ratings and complaints and things on file too, so that's one more place that you can check for information. Well, you've certainly done an amazing job of helping people across East County, and in fact, all over San Diego County to get back on their feet. And it's great to hear that so many of them have. What percentage would you say of those, you know, who suffered these losses have managed to rebuild or move forward with their lives in some positive direction?
Well, I wish I could say 100%, but I know it's not. The last figures I heard were, which were, you know, probably 5 years ago, maybe 70% have rebuilt.
And it should be said that of those who didn't, some of them chose not to. They chose to sell the property and move out of state. Are there still some who are, you know, living in trailers or just unable to get back on their feet that you're aware of, Kathy?
I'm sure there are. It just depends on what area of the county. I know that there's some areas that at one point the county said, you know, you can no longer have your trailer in here. And you need to either get a building permit or move on.
Wow.
I know that there were some that just decided it was just too much work to try to rebuild. And so they moved to just another area and they still own the property and it sits vacant. So yeah. I think if you were to drive around, you probably would, if you saw a slab sitting on the ground and nothing else around it, more than likely it was a Cedar Fire that chose not to build.
What else would you like our readers to know about the memorial or the ceremony coming up, Kathy?
October 26th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., we will be having a short program.
It's going to be the Lakeside Fire Station.
It's at the Lakeside Fire Station. Besides the dedication of the land, we have invited other entities, those groups that helped the Cedar Fire rebuild, to set up tables, display tables. We hope to have maybe some items that people can look at that survived the fire. The fire department's going to be there with the various fire equipment, fire repression equipment. Mm-hmm. And we just invite the public to come out. And we're also really would like to extend an invitation to all the Cedar Fire families to please come back, reconnect, let us reflect, and let us remember.
Yeah, that is the slogan, reflect, remember, and reconnect as we look back 10 years after the Cedar Fire. Well, we're certainly glad that you and your family were able to get back on your feet and rebuild and come back stronger than ever. And I think you've mentioned to us that you have a license plate that pretty well sums up your philosophy in all of this. Can you close by telling us about that?
Yes, my kids bought me a personalized license plate that says the Phoenix and risen from the ashes. And so that's just kind of been our philosophy, is that we were just going to continue to rise from the ashes bigger and better.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for joining us here today on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
This is Connie Beck with Ready, Set, Grow. I'm going to help you create healthy and beautiful gardens using less money, less hard work, and much more fun. It's time to start planting for this fall, and that means you need your tools to be in good shape. So how exactly do we keep our tools in good shape? Well, for one thing, we don't leave them laying out in the rain, if it ever rains again. And we don't want to put them away dirty with mud on them and dirt on them. We want everything to be cleaned up and put in a proper place inside the garage, the basement, or a tool shed of some sort. One of the cute ideas that some of my students like is buying an old used mailbox at a garage sale and posting that someplace in their garden so they can have a second set of tools or even a third one out there to grab when they see something they need to do, and that way they don't have to go all the way back to the house to get the right tool, and it is out of the way. Now, how do we clean these tools when we're through with them? Well, obviously, you can hose off your shovels, rakes, hose, things like that. I have a trick that I learned years ago that I really enjoy, and I think it's wonderful. And even my husband, who's not quite as hyper attuned to cleaning tools as I am, likes this one. We take an old cat litter box, and we fill it with sand and pour a quart of motor oil into it, stir it up real well, and we can slide the shovels, the rakes, and everything into that box and get a light coating of oil on the tools before we hang them up. This also has the benefit of taking the small nicks and scrapes off the edges of the tools before you put it away. Sometimes we have wooden handle tools. I love wooden handle tools. They're much better than fiberglass as far as I'm concerned. How do you keep those wooden handles nice? That's the job for a little bit of sandpaper sometimes, and then coat them about once a year with boiled linseed oil. You can also use mineral oil. You can also use expensive olive oil. The point is, you're using an oil on these wooden handles at least once a year to keep them smooth and working well. When you are using your tools for pruning outside, your loppers, your hand pruners and everything, they have a tendency to get gummy. They get all sorts of sap on them. There's an expensive product out there that you can buy that'll remove that, but you can also remove the sap and the gumminess on the blades of your tools with alcohol, just plain rubbing alcohol on a rag, rub it onto the gicky stuff on the edges of the tools, and then leave it for 3 or 4 minutes. And then when you come back, you can use that same rag and just wipe them off totally clean. There is also a tiny tool out there. It costs about $10 or $12. Look for it, and you will find it. It is a gardening tool sharpener, which you run over the blades of your loppers and your hand pruners, your bypass tools, and it will clean them. And it will sharpen them again instantly. 3 passes and you're good. It is not the same as a knife sharpener, so don't buy a knife sharpener and think that's going to work.
What other tools do we need to take care of? Well, you need to take care of your hands. So for that, I recommend you get some really good gloves. Gloves that are fabric that have a vinyl-dipped fingers and hands and palms are absolutely great. They last longer than you think they will. Sometimes at one of the big box stores, you can buy a package of 6 or 8 pairs of these for about $1 a pair. They're worth their weight in gold. They'll keep your hands from feeling like, as my husband once said to me, holding hands with you is like holding hands with a pineapple. You can avoid that by wearing gloves when you do your gardening. And then I want to say a kind and loving word towards your favorite item that you need here where we water every week, and that is your garden hoses. Garden hoses should never be stowed with kinks in them. That destroys the hose in record time. Also, when the hoses are stretched out and you're using them, don't step on them. You may think that it's not going to do any harm, but it will, because small rocks can poke a hole in the side of your expensive garden hose, faster even in your cheaper garden hoses. So don't do that. Be kind to your garden hoses. Coil them up nicely with no kinks and put them away after each use.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's live radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.